I want to share a few thoughts with you about Yom HaTzmaut and approach it by way of Eretz Yisrael in general. I think the best way to do this is to start with Chazal. There's some very fascinating Chazals. The Gemara says in Ksubis that many of us are familiar with. Kladar b'chutz laretz dome kemisha ein lo eloka. Anybody who lives in chutz laretz, it's like he doesn't have a god. Kladar b'chutz laretz ki lo obed avodas kochavim. Anybody who lives in chutz laretz, it's like he's an obed avodas zara. Wow. Why is that? Question number one. What's so severe? Why is Eretz Yisrael so chashev that living in Eretz Yisrael is like having a god and living in chutz laretz is like living in avodas zara? The Gemara tells stories in Ksubis. Rabbi Zera, ki abiselik l'Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Zera, when he came up to Eretz Yisrael, lo ashkach nivra l'me'abar. So he had to cross the Jordan River. There was no ferry to take him across. So nakab b'mitzra v'ka'avar. So he grabbed on to some kind of, I don't know what it was, a branch or a rope, something, and he managed to make his way over the river into Eretz Yisrael. Amar le'ahut tzduki. So there's a certain tzduki, a heretic, and he sees what Reb Zera is doing, and he says to him, "Ama paziza, the kadmisu pumaychu ludnaychu, you hasty nation, that at Har Sinai kadmisu pumaychu ludnaychu, you preceded your mouth to your ears, you said nasa v'nishma, you acted in a hasty way. So akati bipsisu chayz tzaychu kadmisu, you still maintain the haste, you act without thinking. What are you doing? It's dangerous. Just wait a few minutes, the ferry will come, we'll take you across the river. Why are you doing it like that?" So Amar Leir, Reb Zera said back to the Tzduki, Duchta de Moshe v'Aaron lo zachula, the place that Moshe and Aaron didn't merit to come into. Ana miyemar dezachinola, who says that I'm going to make it in? Unless I seize the moment right now and come to Eretz Yisrael, who says I'm going to get in? Rabbi Abba menashek kipe de Akko. Rabbi Abba, when he came to Eretz Yisrael, he kissed the stones in Akko. And that's a very nice story, but the Rambam quotes it in the Mishneh Torah. Halacha sefer, gdolei chachamim hayu menashkin al tchumei Eretz Yisrael, menashkin avaneo misgalgalin al afara. The gdolei chachamim who come to Eretz Yisrael, kiss the ground, kiss the stones, roll around in the dirt. Wow, so undignified. Rabbi Chanina hayu misakin mitkalei. Rabbi Chanina, when he came to Eretz Yisrael, he would help arrange the streets. He would straighten the roads so that people shouldn't complain about Eretz Yisrael. Nobody should speak bad about Eretz Yisrael. The roads should be in order. Rabbi Amid, Rabbi Asi, Kaimu hayukamim v'zazim mimukomim b'yosachama mishim shalatula. That in the summertime, Rabbi Amid and Rabbi Asi would get up from the sun and they would go sit in the shade. And in the wintertime, they would get up from the shade, they would go down and sit in the sun. Why is that? In order that they shouldn't complain about anything in Eretz Yisrael. That they should be as comfortable as possible here in Eretz Yisrael, that they shouldn't complain. And Rabbi Chiya bar Gamra, Megander, he would roll around in the dirt in Eretz Yisrael when he came here. Why? What is so chash about Eretz Yisrael that warrants this type of behavior, warrants these types of statements from Chazal? My father was the first of his family. My father's Israeli, he was born here in 1951. His family, comes from a family of nine. He's the fifth child. And he was the first one here born in Eretz Yisrael. Everybody else was born in Morocco. So in Morocco, I always hear the stories since I'm a little kid. In Morocco, my grandfather had a very prominent position in the community. He was a musician. They had servants who would serve them and a large house and lots of money. And my grandfather was an ardent Zionist. He left everything behind. My grandmother didn't want to come. He left everything behind. We're going to Eretz Yisrael. They came to Eretz Yisrael. They came here in 1951. Into a ma'abara, which was like a camp that the Ashkenazim basically put the Sephardim in when they came to Eretz Yisrael. And you hear all the stories about, you know, stealing kids and stuff like that. Probably happened over there. My dad was born in the ma'abara in a tent. And later on, the two guys moving into the first apartment, they're nine kids. I mean, at that time, there was only five. But they had two rooms in the apartment, a bedroom and a main room, no electricity. He remembers when they installed the first light bulb, and he stood there turning off the light and turning on the light. Why do that? What's so important? Why give up so much, give up everything and come here? My Rebbe, who anybody who's in my shirim has heard about a lot, Rav Sinai Adler, Shlita. So he likes to describe when he's a Holocaust survivor. So after the war ended, he was in England for a few months. And from England, he got on a boat and he was able to come to Eretz Yisrael. So he describes sitting on the boat, and when he could see Eretz Yisrael in the distance, so he went up to the front of the boat, to like the point, and he sat all the way at the tip of the boat. So he was 16 years old at the time, 17. So that he could be as close as possible to Eretz Yisrael. Where is that? Where does that come from? So there's a famous Ruchaim Velazhin in Pirkei Avos where he says that Asar Nisyonos Nisnasa Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu was tested with 10 trials. One of those trials is Lech Lecha Ma'aretzuch Ulatcha B'Savicha. One of those was to go to Eretz Yisrael. And Ruchaim Velazhin says those 10 trials of Avram Avinu built into the genetic makeup of a Jewish person certain midos and certain feelings, certain character. And one of those feelings is a love for Eretz Yisrael. And he says sometimes, you don't even know why, you have this feeling all of a sudden, you have a feeling of love towards Eretz Yisrael. You don't know where it's coming from. He says it's coming all the way back from Avraham Avinu. But let's say, explain maybe a little bit more. A couple other things that I heard from Rav Sinai over the years. Fascinating thing. First of all, the first Rashi in Chumash, Bereishis Bara Elokim es Hashamayim es Haaretz, that Hashem created the world. So Rashi asks, why does the Torah start with Hashem creating the world? Why not start with HaChodesh HaZeh Lechem, the first mitzvah in the Torah? And Rashi says that Hashem created the world, and this is put in the Chumash to teach us that Hashem also made Eretz Yisrael, and He gave it to certain nations up until a certain point in history. There's going to come a time where Hashem's going to take it away from them and give it to the Jewish people. And those nations are going to complain, and they're going to say, you guys are thieves and robbers, you took Eretz Yisrael away from us, and we have now the right to respond. Just look in Chumash, look in the Torah. Hashem created the whole world is His. He gave it to you guys up until a certain point in time, now He's taking Eretz Yisrael and He's giving it to us. So from Rashi, from the first words in Chumash, the Chumash is already focused on Eretz Yisrael. The next story in Chumash of Adam and Chava, the Torah says, this also Rav Sinai is fond of saying, Vayikach Hashem Elokim es Adam vayenichivu b'gan Eden la'avda l'shamra. Hashem took Adam and He put him in Gan Eden. So Rashi says, Vayikach Hashem took Adam l'kachol b'dvarim na'im u'pitohu l'kanes. Hashem took Adam Arishon with nice words and He convinced him to go into Gan Eden. So Rav Sinai like to ask, like, where was he that he had to be convinced to go into Gan Eden? He said he was in Eretz Yisrael. Adam Arishon was in Israel, he didn't want to leave. He didn't even leave to go to Gan Eden. The Ramban says in Parshas Noach that the whole world feels the mabul. There was no mabul in Eretz Yisrael. When the dove went out and got a leaf from the olive tree, so there was only an olive tree there in Eretz Yisrael because there was no mabul here to destroy it. Of course, the waters flowed in from the outside, but there was no mabul in Eretz Yisrael. Then Avraham Avinu with Lech Lecha, the whole Chumash from the first word until the very, very end, with Moshe Rabbeinu, the whole Chumash is one big story that revolves around Eretz Yisrael. So what's so special? And I think the answer to what's so special is a pasuk in Parshas Ekev, and that's what we're going to talk about now for a few minutes. The Torah says, Eretz asher Hashem Elokecha doresh osa tamid, enei Hashem Elokecha ba mireshis hashana ved achrishana. Eretz Yisrael is the place in the world that Hashem Elokecha doresh osa tamid. Hashem is always involved in Eretz Yisrael. There's hashkacha pratis here in every area, in a much more overt way than it exists anywhere else in the world. Rav Zevin has a very nice article that I found, where Rav Zevin describes that the Kiddush of Eretz Yisrael, like you see from the sources in Chumash in the very beginning, the Kiddush of Eretz Yisrael, we know there's big machlokas, Kitchel Hashaita, Kitchel Dasid Lavo, the Bia Rishona, and the Bia Shnia, when was Eretz Yisrael endowed with Kiddusha? Rav Zevin writes that whole conversation about Kiddusha of Eretz Yisrael only relates to the Kiddusha of mitzvahs at Tzvus Ba'aretz. That's true when it comes to all the agricultural mitzvahs that we have over here. But the essential Kiddusha of Eretz Yisrael is something that was there from the very beginning. Hashem chose Eretz Yisrael as the chosen land for a reason. There's something that distinguishes it from everything else. Eine Hashem Elokecha Ba. Hashem is Doresh Tamid Eretz Yisrael. And to me, as a frum Jew, this is so obvious. It's the most, I think, the most powerful proof people, you know, talk about, oh, you believe in God, you know, what are the proofs, and you can philosophize from here until forever about all the different conversations that people have. To me, perhaps the biggest proof, the most obvious evidence that there's a God in the world and that Hashem is controlling the world is just the history of this country that we're living in right now. 1948, after the UN partition plan, so Israel accepted, the Jews accepted, there was no Israel at that time, the Jews accepted the UN partition plan that was meant to split the country over here, the state, into two parts, a very small Jewish part and a larger Arab part. And that left out Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim was not supposed to be part of the state of Israel. It left out, obviously, the Golan Heights and the West Bank. And Eretz Israel would be a very small piece of what we now consider to be the state of Israel. And the Jews accepted the partition plan, and the Arabs did not. And they waged war immediately, right after the Declaration of Independence. And Israel was attacked from the north, and Lebanon, and Syria, and Iraq, and then go around from Jordan, and from Egypt, the whole millions, tens of millions of Arabs, hundreds of millions of Arabs and their armies had a mantra of we're going to now throw the Jews into the sea, and they attacked this tiny little, not even existing yet country that was made up of a lot of Holocaust survivors and refugees and people who were not, you know, an elite fighting force. And just even the eagle's eye view of what happened in 1948 and the word independence is such a great, such an overt miracle that it begs emunah. And that's been the theme of the country ever since then. Now they're in 2019. For the last 71 years, that's what it's been all about. There's a book, a beautiful book called Hatkufa HaGdolah by Menachem Kasher, where he describes a lot of the, and he discusses a lot of the issues from a religious perspective in terms of the state of Israel and the history that went into establishing the state and the like. And he has there a list of stories, very short stories and statements about things that people experienced. The part that I photocopied happened to be in the 1967 war, in the Six-Day War. My father was 16 years old at the time in 1967, and people were sure, they're again, attacked from all sides, again, millions of people, we're going to throw them into the sea, and the people who were living here, the civilian population, and I think a lot of the military population was saying on the inside, but people were convinced that this is the end of the country. They were sure their deaths were coming. There were people who were already digging mass graves for all the casualties they were expecting. They were going to be attacked from the air by all these different armies. And we know there was the miracle there also, but I just want to read you a couple of your stories that Rav Kasher brings down. I tried to find the ones that were maybe the most relevant that we could identify with a little bit. The first one, LeBeit Knesset Shel Sfaradim B'Shchunat Kiryat Yovel. Right, Kiryat Yovel is right up the hill over here. I'm sure many of you have been there or seen it. So there's a Sephardic shul in Kiryat Yovel, Chadar Pagaz. So a missile landed a direct hit in the shul. Nagada Paruchet Shal Arona Kodesh Venetzar. It hit right into the Arona Kodesh, into the Paruchas of the Aron, and it stopped. Vilu B'Sifrei HaTorah Sheba Aron Lo Paga. But no damage was done to the Sifrei Torah. Beautiful. B'Shkunat Me'a Sha'arim Shib Yisholayim and Me'a Sha'arim. Yashav Lo Rav Yeshua Mintzer. V'Lamad B'Shkeda B'Chedro. Rav Yeshua Mintzer. I only found out about him this morning when I read the story. So he was sitting and learning in his room. Shakua haya b'limudo v'lo shama l'tzofrei hazakashi hibhadhu ba'avir. So he's sitting and learning. He didn't hear the sirens that were tearing through the air. The karu lezrachim l'red l'mikatim that was calling all the citizens to go down into the safe rooms. L'chadro chadar pagaz b'rashu b'zam. So a missile landed right in his room. Nach baritzpa liado ke'evin she'en lo'ofin. Landed on the floor right next to where he was sitting, like a rock that can't be moved. Liadak marab tucha, right next to his open gemara. He was sitting and it didn't explode. Landed in his room. Pagaz gadol nafal al hagag shel beit acholim Shari Tzedek Yerushalayim. A missile landed right on the roof of the Shari Tzedek Hospital in Yerushalayim. Mimal acheder hapeutot shenoldu beotam hayamim. Right on top of the room of the babies that were just born. Chadar tinukot kosa loven. The whole, it erupted the roof and, broke a hole right through it. There was all the white was, from the, when you break the wall, that white stuff that comes out all over the place, the dust and whatever it is, was covering the whole room. Hatiach nitkalef, the tiach, the plaster all peeled off. Hilbina nereshatot shekisur arisot amalayot yeladim. They covered, the plaster covered the nets that were covering over the cradles of all the babies were in. Avolo garam shum nezek velo pagam atinokot. Not one baby was hurt. Chablenei tzal horidu et apagaz hagadol shelo yitoktzen. Again, also there, the missile didn't blow up, and the army came and removed the missile. Hasamal David, Shaya Batok Tank Bisinai Siper. Sergeant David, who was in a tank in Sinai, told the following story. Kasher Paga Pagaz Mitri Batank Patom Bonimza Hechela Tank Livor. He was in a tank, and the tank suffered a direct hit from an Egyptian tank, and the tank caught on fire. They tried to get out of the tank and they couldn't. They were in this tank, and the missile that hit the tank that they were in bent the door of the tank, and they couldn't get out. So they were ready to die. They started to say Shema Yisrael. They got to the word Vahafta. A miracle happened. A second Egyptian missile hit the tank and opened up the door. The whole thing, they were all saved. Everybody was fine. One after the other. Do I have another one over here in this book? No. The stories are endless. In the early 90s, there was the Persian Gulf War. So Saddam Hussein sent 39 Scud missiles. In 1973, talk about that also, but I'll talk about it for a second. In 1973, we know the Yom Kippur War. First thing, my father fought in the Yom Kippur War. And despite that, the first thing I always think about when I hear about the Yom Kippur War is from Benny Eisner, Zichrono Levracha, who was a Rebbe here in Har Yeshiva. So he was a Talmud of Ritzi Yehuda Cook. Ritzi Yehuda Cook was the son of Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook that many of us have heard of. He was the Rosh Yeshiva Merkaz Harav, which is right over here in Yerushalayim. So Benny at the time was learning in Merkaz Harav. And on Yom Kippur, so the soldiers were called up, you know, all the reserves were called up that they should join the war efforts. They were a surprise attack from the Egyptians and from the Syrians in the south and the north, and they needed every man. So Rav Benny described it. I can't remember if it was Shacharis or if it was Musaf, but it was in the middle of Shmona Esrei, and they got the call, and Rav Benny said he himself went over to Ritzi Yehuda, who was in the middle of, you know, tapping Yom Kippur. And he said, I remember watching him describe that he went to Ritzi Yehuda, he said to him, Harav, you know, and the Shiva, you know, when the Gedolei Hador, he's standing there in the middle of Shmona Esrei and Yom Kippur, and so he obviously ignores. He's like, Harav, ignore. Harav, you know, Harav! Could you imagine like the silence of the room in the middle of davening in Yom Kippur? So he's screaming, Harav, and finally, with his eyes, like, you know, like, what are you doing? So he told him, we've been called to war. There's a war, we're attacked all around. We need you to daven for us. And that's how he left. So in 1973, the Syrians came in from the north. Nobody was expecting it. They came down, I remember, it was almost all the way to Haifa. They came down so far that they thought it was a trap. The Israeli army was so unprepared. There was such an unexpected attack that the Syrians were sure that they were going to come in so far and then the Israelis were going to catch them from the back and cut them off back from Syria and then ambush them, that they stopped going further. Just because they were scared, they couldn't believe that it was so easy. And there's crazy stories. I forgot the name of the... There was a guy, Spika something. I don't know if anybody knows the story here. This one guy in one tank held off like 100 Syrian tanks. Okay, I don't have that story in front of me, and it's a long one anyway. In the early 90s, during the Persian Gulf War, 39 Scud missiles fell here. I think one person died as a result of the Scud missiles that fell here. I saw an article that pointed out there was one Scud missile that fell on an American army base or something somewhere here in the Middle East, and tens of people were killed by that one Scud. Here in Israel, 39 Scuds fell in very populated civilian areas. One person died. Somebody once told me they died of a heart attack also, not even from the missile. I read a story about this lady who... during that time, an old lady who lived by herself, in the middle of the night, she got a knock on her door, and it was the neighbors, the family of neighbors, and they told her, you know, there's all these missiles coming now, and you have to be careful. Why don't you come and stay over at our house? That way, if you need help in the middle of the night, getting to the safe room or whatever, like, we'll be there to help you. And she said, you know, it's a good idea. Let's do that. So they come to her house, help her get her stuff. As they leave her house, right in between, and they're in between, outside, in between the two houses, a Scud missile lands somewhere in this alley between the two houses, and both houses are totally demolished, and all the people from both houses were outside were saved. Like, there's a story about a Scud missile that landed on a pipe, an oil pipeline, where if it would have hit that line, like, there would have been massive explosions going out through all the line, and it was just recently that they had, like, circumvented that line, and so it landed on the old one and not on the new one. Not much like Nisim every turn here throughout the whole history of the country. I'll tell you a first-hand story quickly. I'm going to try to end on time. I'll tell you a first-hand story of somebody who gave out Mordechai. A lot of my guys have probably heard this story already, but it's such a good one. This is from the last war in Gaza. And they're endless. These are just like not even the tips of the icebergs, these stories. In the last war in Gaza, which was, 2014, something like that. So there was, the soldiers went in, the ground invasion into Gaza, and one of the guys in Givon Mordechai, he was called up as part of the reserves, and his job is he was the lead commander of this group of soldiers that went in, so his job was to be the lead man into the houses that they went into in Gaza. The way they worked was they would go into a certain house. Most of the houses had already been abandoned in all the areas that they were fighting. They would go into a certain house, commandeer the house, take it over, and then use that house as a point of operations, the base, for however long they needed it, until they would then move on to the next area. So this guy's job was to be the lead man in. Now, the lead man in's job is always the most dangerous because sometimes the houses were booby-trapped and there could be all sorts of things lurking behind for them. And so he takes his soldiers in, and he knocks down this door of a certain house. And when he knocks down the door, he sees right in front of him an Arab soldier who's standing at the ready with his gun facing him, and he knows, this is the end of his life. And, he says, okay, I'm not going to go down without a fight. I'll see what I can do. And so he, as quickly as he can, picks up his gun, and he shoots. He shoots before the other guy gets a shot off. But when he pulls the trigger, so his gun jams, and the bullet doesn't come out. And he's like, then he really, starts to panic. And you can imagine, in the meantime, he first opens the door, he processes that there's a guy there, he pulls up his gun, he tries to shoot, it doesn't work, he panics. How long does that take? I don't know, 5, 6, 7 seconds? So the whole time, the other guy's standing there. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and the other guy's not doing anything. So he starts to become, the panic's, it's like sidelined a little bit, and he becomes curious, what's going on over here? He takes a closer look, takes a step closer, the guy's still not moving, and he sees that it's a mannequin that was dressed like an Arab with the gun, put the gun in hand, they dressed it all up and put the thing around his face, and it's not real. And when he approaches the mannequin, he sees from the backside the whole thing is filled with explosives. And if he would have shot the mannequin, so the whole house would have came down and it would have killed him and his whole group. And because his gun jammed, which is mamish nis, the guns don't jam. They check them, a million times before they go into real battle. And his gun jammed. Every step of the way, this country is built on these kind of miracles. And I think that that's the idea, one of the many ideas of the pasuk that Hashem doresho satanid. Hashem is constantly involved here in Eretz Yisrael, and the Hashkacha Pratis that you see here is not like anything else in the world. And that's why it's so chashuv to be here. That's why being in Eretz Yisrael is like having a God, and being in Chutz Lars is like being a Avodah Zarah, because the level of divine experience that you have here is unparalleled. That's why when the Tanaim and the Chachamim come to Eretz Yisrael, they kiss the ground and they roll around in the dirt, because it's an expression of the Avas Hashem, the relationship, the close relationship that comes out between Bnei Yisrael and Hashem here in Eretz Yisrael. Just two minutes. Yom HaTzma'ut, I remember when I was Shana Aleph, or Shana Bet, whichever, I don't remember which one it was, probably Shana Bet. No, maybe Shana Aleph, actually. It was Shana Aleph. It was the end of the year. So in the Vasaret at that time, the Israelis, the Kolel ran the Beis Medrash, I don't know what it's like today, but so there was a very Zionistic Kolel, and so they said Hallel on Yom HaTzmud at night with the bracha. This is not a halacha shmud at all. We're not talking about anything halachic. They said Hallel at night, I think even with the bracha. At least some people said with the bracha on Yom HaTzmud, and again in the daytime. And so I asked Rav Sinai, should we say Hallel on Yom HaTzmud? He said, well, are you thankful that we have the state of Israel here that we can run to and be protected by, and all the things that we discussed today, and many, many more things that are beyond the scope of the few minutes that we have? So I said, of course, thankful, yeah, for sure. So he said, so they say Hallel, why not? So he said, should we say a bracha? So he said, no, we don't say a bracha on Hallel. No, there's no bracha. Now, I'm not getting involved in halacha now at all, but the hashkafa shibo, the perspective, is critical, that we have to appreciate what it is that we have here, what a unique opportunity in history that we have here. Rav Miller from the Kollel used to tell us when I was in the Kollel, he said there are essentially four perspectives on the matzmut that you find in the world. Three are acceptable and one is not. He said there's the extreme perspective of Satmar, that from the Gemara of Ksubis about the Gimel Shvuos, that we have a Shvuah, we're now allowed to come to Israel en masse, and certainly not by force. And essentially, the establishment of the State of Israel is an expression of the Maisa Satan in the world, and it's a roadblock that is hindering the coming of Mashiach. That's one approach that was endorsed by the Satmar Rav and Sefer Vayal Moshe, and that's the Satmar community believes today. There's that opposite extreme of the Rav Kook camp, where they believe that the establishment of the State of Israel is the Atchalta of the Geula, it's the onset of the process of Geula, that this is ultimately going to lead to the coming of Mashiach, and it's all going to happen within the context of this State of Israel. There's the middle approach, which he described as the Rav's approach, from Soloveitchik, where in Kol Dodi Dofeik, he essentially says that the establishment of the State of Israel is an opportunity that Hashem is giving us, and what we do with that opportunity really depends on us. If we utilize it and we take advantage of it, so Eretz Yisrael maybe will be ultimately the onset of the Geula. And if we squander the opportunity, so it'll be just another blip on the map of history. And those are three acceptable approaches, because they're approaches that are endorsed by Gedolei Yisrael. Ultimately we'll find out who's right. But three acceptable approaches calls to mind that we don't have the final answer. But there's one approach that he says unacceptable. And he said his language was, this is the kafir approach. The kafir approach is to just not recognize, not relate to the fact that such significant events have happened in our history. Right? I'm not talking about Yom HaTzmut specifically only, but the establishment of the State of Israel and everything that came along with that and the way it affects all of our lives today is something that's so significant and so different and such an outlier in terms of how things have always been for us as a people, that to ignore it and not to realize and not to recognize that, that's kfira. That's denying Hashem's hand in the world. And that's not acceptable. Have two more minutes? Sorry. I apologize. I really apologize to all of you, because Rabbi Vasquez is going to speak after me for a few minutes. So it's my fault that we're going a little over, not his fault. But I just want to end off with a story. So you hear these four different types of people, and we see, you look around the State of Israel today, it's so diverse, but that diversity comes in a very negative light, with people fighting with each other and speaking badly about each other, and we're in all these different camps and we can't manage to get along with each other, and you have to wonder how it's all going to play out. And obviously I don't have the answer to that question, but I just want to share with you a story. I'll end with this that I heard on Shabbos, and I think the yisod of the story gives a little hope for our situation here. There was a boy, a young man, walking down the street here on Rehov Saratskin, here in Yerushalayim, and he saw a sign that somebody needed a bone marrow donation. And they were asking people to come and, get tested to see if they're a match for this boy. His life depended on it. So this guy's walking down the street. He sees the sign. He's like, you know what? I'll go see. It's a cheek swab. It's not a big deal. Or however they did it. This was years ago. However they did it back then. And so he goes and he gets tested. And however long later he gets the results, it turns out that he's a match for this boy. So he's like, okay, wow, wonderful. So he goes to the place, and they start explaining to him the process of what's going to be, and he asks them, you know what, if it's okay, I'd really like to meet the person that needs this, this person who's a little bit older than him. I'd like to meet this person who needs the donation, maybe talk to him. So they said, okay, we'll check with the other side, see how he feels about that. The other guy agreed. So they had a meeting. The other guy was a chiloni person, and they started talking, and they really hit it off, and they developed a bond. And, okay, the guy goes home. He tells his father the whole story. He says, Dad, a few weeks ago, I was walking down the street. I saw the sign, bone marrow. I got tested. It turns out I'm a match. I met the person who needs the donation. He's this great person. He's telling him the whole story. The father's very taken. Wow, what a beautiful thing. No, what's his name? So the boy tells the father the name and the last name. And the father, turns white. And he said, forget it, you're not doing anything with bone marrow. He's like, what do you mean? He's like, no, you're not. It's not going to happen. He's like, Dad, this is pikuach nefesh, I need to donate to save his life. Of course I'm donating. He's like, you're not donating. And that's the end of the story. I'm not going to talk about it anymore. He's like, what do you mean? Why? End of conversation. So the kid's very you know, disturbed. He goes to the Rav, their shul, and tells the Rav the whole story. And the Rav says, you know, let's go together. We'll talk to your father, see what the story is. So the Rav goes and he starts explaining to him, it's pikuach nefesh and so important, and, you know, the whole. And the father is like, bishalom, it's not happening. And finally, the father relents and he says, okay, you want to know why? I'll explain to you the reason. He said, the father himself is a Holocaust survivor. And he said, that family, that name, I know exactly who that person is. The father of this boy who needs the donation, I know exactly who it is. I'll tell you a story of what happened to him and me when we were together in one of the ghettos. He said, in that ghetto, I had a son. And all the children had been taken out. And my son was hiding in the rafters of the bunk where we were living. And we were like that for a long time. He was hiding in the rafters. And it happened to be that this son of mine, he was a child, he would sneak out at night. He would go into the Nazis' kitchen. He would steal food. He would bring it back. And the people in our bunk, we had extra food to eat because my son would steal the food. At a certain point in time, the Nazis caught on that somebody was stealing the food. And they knew it was coming from our bunk for whatever reason, whatever the circumstances were. And they decided that they're going to find the guilty party. So that the father of this boy who needs the donation, he's Jewish, obviously, also. And he knew how to make bombs. So the Nazis employed him as a bomb maker. And he was the one who came with the two SS soldiers into our bunk. And he was the one who went with his stick, knocking on all the walls and knocking on the ceiling. And he was the one who, when he hit the ceiling, the rafters broke and my son came tumbling down. And he was the one who, with the Nazis, took my son outside of the bunk. And two shots later, he was gone. So he killed my son. And if he killed my son, I'm not going to save his son today. That's the end of the story. They heard that. And, you know, it's a tough thing to hear. But in the end of the day, still, this boy is an innocent boy. And we can't play judge like that. And the Rav was trying to convince the father. And the father was, and he said, you know what? How about at least, let's find that other person. Let's find that man that you've been hating so much for all these years. At least let's talk to him about it. You never know what the real story was. Maybe there's something you didn't understand. There's something going on. At least speak to him before you make this final decision. And the father says, you know what? Fine, I'll speak to him. And the Rav arranges this meeting, and the two get together, and you can see the father of the boy who can donate, the hatred already in his eyes, and he looks at this other man whose son is now deathly ill. And the man with the sick son says to his counterpart, he says, I'm sure that he must be very angry at me. He must be hating me for so many years since what happened. So I just want to explain to you what really happened. I was a bomb maker for the Nazis, and they needed me. And when they heard that somebody was stealing food from the kitchen, when they figured that out, they were going to go and they were going to kill everybody in your bunk. And I convinced them that instead of killing everybody in the bunk, let's just find the one guilty party and just kill that person. And so they said, okay, that's your idea, we'll accept your idea. You'll find the party, you'll find the guilty person, and you'll be the one to kill them. So he said, I had no choice. I went into your bunk, and I banged on all the walls, and I banged on the roof, and the boy fell out, and I took him outside. And then there were two gunshots. And I fired the gun. He said, but I didn't fire the gun at your son. I killed those two Nazi guards who had taken me in, and I took your son, and I sent him to a monastery to be protected for the rest of the war. And the Nazis found out what I did, and they castrated me, and they tortured me, and they kept me alive because they needed me to make the bombs. But at the end of the war, I went back to the monastery, I got the boy, and I looked for you. I looked for you for years. I looked for you for years. And you came to Eretz Yisrael, you changed your name. He Hebraicized his name, apparently, when he came here. And I couldn't find you. So I adopted this child as my own child. And I raised him. I never get, at a family simcha, I never get through a speech. So this is pretty good that I've gotten this far. I raised him as my own child. And now he's sick. And he needs a bone marrow donation. So this boy, you get it. It's your son. So the father, obviously, even more emotional than I am, so they hugged each other and etc. You can live your life for many, many years thinking certain things are right, be convinced of the absolute truth of your cause, and in one moment, you can see a different truth. And ultimately, when the Mashiach does come, Samir Tashen, that's what happened.